Laudator Jesus Christus. Praise be Jesus Christ. Welcome, friends, to another episode of Council of Faith. We're examining the post-conciliar documents of Vatican II. Today we're going to examine a particular document entitled the Declaration on Euthanasia. This was issued from the Sacred Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith in 1980. We're told in the very introduction of the document, the Council, that is the Second Vatican Council, condemned crimes against life such as any type of murder, genocide, abortion, euthanasia, or willful suicide. That was in Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 27. Throughout this whole series, what we've been doing is using these documents that have come after the Council, but have been motivated, if not directly, perhaps indirectly, by the conciliar decrees themselves. Previous episode, we looked at the issue of abortion. There was a declaration on the immorality of abortion. This one is talking about euthanasia. When we look at this document, it tells us, human life is the basis of all goods and is the necessary source and condition of every human activity and of all society. It's the basic fundamental right, the right to life. And if it's whether we're talking about the right to life of the unborn, the conceived human person in the womb, or the elderly person in the nursing home, or the sick and dying person in the hospital. Human life is the same across the board. There are various stages of human life. We are judged by our age in terms of chronology, but on a moral plane, there is no difference. Whether there's a baby in the womb, whether there's a child in school, whether it's a full-grown adult, or someone who's sick and dying in the hospital or nursing home, that is a precious human life made in the image and likeness of God. That doesn't go away. Once a human being is created, and we are created at the moment of conception, there we are in the image and likeness of God, and there's where our human dignity begins. And it only ends when God calls us home, and then we have life to the full extent, an eternal life. The document tells us, in paragraph 1, no one can make an attempt on the life of an innocent person without opposing God's love for that person, without violating a fundamental right, and therefore without committing a crime against of the utmost gravity. We see in the book of Genesis, the first act of murder, Cain kills his brother Abel. Fratricide, killing of one's own brother. If the very first family on earth is able to commit this heinous sin, it's no wonder that now we as a culture and society are able to exterminate people at a vastly large rate. We are rightfully outraged, disgusted, and appalled at the 6 million Jews who were exterminated by Hitler and the Nazis. A horrible, shameful crime that is something that we still need to prevent at all costs, that this will never happen again. We have to also recall the 11 million people that Joseph Stalin had killed. Lithuanians, Latvians, Poles, Russians, anyone that he didn't like were exterminated. What about the hundreds, thousands of African Americans who were killed during the slave trades? Those who were killed on the way over, those who were brutally treated here in the United States. What about those people? And what about the unborn? All human life, doesn't matter what epoch in history we're talking about, doesn't matter what hemisphere, doesn't matter what continent, we're talking about human life. Paragraph 2. Everyone has the duty to lead his or her life in accordance with God's plan. That life is entrusted to the individual as a good that must bear fruit already here on earth, but that finds its full perfection only in eternal life. Yes, life develops. It grows. And certainly, from the moment of conception, the human being develops, and we keep growing, we keep changing. Even in old age, we're continuing to change. The only time we stop is at the moment of death, and then the great change occurs. If we, God willing, end up in heaven, we have life to its full extent. All things will be granted to us. Our intellect and our will be totally perfected. Our intellect, which is a faculty of the soul, seeks the truth. Our will, which seeks the good, we find its complete perfection in God, because God is truth, He is goodness, the summum bonum, as St. Thomas would call him, the supreme good. But just because we are growing and developing doesn't mean, well, we're not finished yet, therefore, until it's finished, does that mean you can stop it? No. In paragraph 3, intentionally causing one's own death or suicide is therefore equally as wrong as murder. Such an action on the part of a person is to be considered a rejection of God's sovereignty and His loving plan. Furthermore, suicide is also often a refusal of the love of oneself, the denial of the natural instinct to live, a flight from the duties of justice and charity owed towards one's neighbor, to various communities, or to the whole of society. And then we're also told in this same paragraph, although it's generally recognized at times there are psychological factors present that can diminish the responsibility or even completely remove it, it is still a grave evil. We have to recall that those people who are under such psychological stress or abnormalities, if someone's psychologically under the control of drugs, for instance, someone is in a psychotic episode, someone has a condition where they're unable to distinguish reality from fantasy, those people are not morally culpable for their actions. So someone who commits suicide, but because they're unable to distinguish reality, they're either under the influence of narcotic drugs or of some psychological condition that renders them incapable of knowing what's real and what's not. That's a whole different category. And because of that, we never know the exact condition of someone. The church no longer prevents a Catholic burial, as we used to in the old days, for someone who commits suicide. In the old days, if someone committed suicide, they were denied Catholic burial because it was presumed, well, they were guilty of a mortal sin. But just as in the same way we're not sure what's in the heart, only God knows that, we give them the benefit of the doubt that we are hoping that the reason why they did was through enormous, horrible stress, anxiety, which only medication and treatment maybe or maybe not could have alleviated. But that normally speaking, without treatment, they were unable to stop themselves. What the document is talking, however, is that we live in a society that sort of is casual about suicide. Not just mercy killing, which is this disgusting euphemism for euthanasia, but look at how many young people commit suicide. Certainly they're under enormous stress these days, and certainly anyone who's lost a young person, we want them to know that you are in our prayers, and we presume with almost total moral certainty that any time a young person commits suicide, that they did so without full faculties or enough sufficient moral reflection to make it a mortal sin. However, the moral obligation of the society as a whole, the movies, the literature, the culture that promotes death, as Pope John Paul tells us, we're in a culture of death. Suicide is mentioned in music, in lyrics, is mentioned in movies, is offered to young people as an alternative to escape. There's where moral obligation comes in. Those of us who are not under this stress, those of us who are not under some psychological abnormality or disorder, and we're now treating it casually. We always treat it for what it is. It's a danger. We're more concerned about cancer, which kills someone just as lethally as suicide. And we want young people to know, if you're contemplating suicide, you need help. You need help right away. We want them to be able to approach anyone. But what are we telling our young people when we say, well, it's okay for Dr. Kevorkian to inject this serum in someone so they can take their life? Well, if a sick and dying person can take their life, why can't a young person? They're only using logic. We're the ones who established that false logic. The document continues. Etymologically speaking, in ancient times, euthanasia meant an easy death without severe suffering. Today, no one longer thinks of its original meaning of the word, rather some intervention of medicine by where the sufferings of sickness or the final agony are reduced, sometimes also with the danger of suppressing life prematurely. Ultimately, the word euthanasia is used more particular to mean, quote, mercy killing, for the purpose of putting to end an extreme suffering, of saving abnormal babies, the mentally ill or incurably sick. Euthanasia, as a term, was particularly used in a very bizarre way by Dr. Josef Mengele in correspondence he had with Hitler. This idea that not only their so-called final solution in exterminating the Jews, they also wanted to get rid of anyone with abnormalities. So they wanted to practice euthanasia. Anyone who had any mental defect, any disability, whether it was mental or physical, terminate them. But they used the phrase euthanasia. It was a type of eugenics, of letting the strongest survive. This Darwinian evolution in terms of society now, that now we were going to actively allow the weaker people of our society to die, and we were going to allow the strong not only to survive, but to predominate. And yet it's in the weak that we find holiness. God tells us He chooses the weak to conquer the strong. God became weak. Imagine the infinite triune God reigning from heaven, now through the incarnation, the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, becomes man in the form of a baby. He first must dwell in his mother's womb for 9 months, vulnerable. He's born. He's a little tiny child. He's vulnerable. When he's dying on the cross, he's not strong. He's not some body builder. He's a typical, ordinary man in his human nature, and they nail him to the cross. It looks as utter, total weakness. And yet it's in that pain and suffering, in that weakness, that we find strength. The document tells us, euthanasia is understood as an action or an omission which of itself or by intention causes death, in order that all suffering may in this way be eliminated. Euthanasia's terms of reference, therefore, are to be found in the intention of the will and the methods that are used. What is the intent? Euthanasia involves this idea that I want the life to end. If the doctor or the nurse is trying to preserve life, is trying to make the patient comfortable, they're not committing euthanasia, at least initially. But if the intent is, I want to end so-and-so's suffering, and how am I going to end their suffering? I have to allow them to die. Allowing them to die and causing them to die are two different premises. We can never commit what we call active or passive euthanasia. Active euthanasia is when I directly cause the death. For instance, I inject a poison into someone's bloodstream. That's active euthanasia. I put a pillow over their head and smother them. Okay? I do something directly to cause their death. That's active euthanasia. Passive euthanasia, that is when I refrain from giving something to someone who is in need of treatment. For instance, they need oxygen. I don't give it to them. They need food. I allow them to starve to death. Okay? That's passive euthanasia. There's also direct and indirect euthanasia. Indirect euthanasia is withholding certain procedures which, under moral terms, are considered extraordinary means. That we are permitted to do. For instance, somebody is 99 years old, they've got cancer, they've already got a broken hip, their organs are starting to shut down, and all of a sudden they go into cardiac arrest and there's an order on the chart, DNR, do not resuscitate. That's morally acceptable. Not to go and do CPR on them. You're allowing the natural process to complete itself. You're not withholding life-saving things like water, food, nutrition, or air, but you're not doing a procedure to prolong the agony. So in Catholic hospitals, Catholic nursing homes, to have that DNR on the chart is morally acceptable when the person's in such a state that it's not going to do anything to help them. There's no quality of life, and the dying process has already begun. However, if someone's robust in health, they could be 95 years old and be in excellent health. They have no cancer, right? They have no broken bones. for you to put a DNR, just, well, grandpa's old, you know, that would not be proper because someone could be saved. We don't know what the extent of their health would be afterwards. But if someone is at such a level, such a stage of dying or deterioration, their health is really starting to go, then you can have such a procedure. That is what we call indirect passive euthanasia. But directly causing the death from withholding treatment or giving them something to cause their death, as what Dr. Kevorkian's been doing, is morally unacceptable. We're also told, it's necessary to state firmly once more that nothing and no one in any way can permit the killing of an innocent human being, whether a fetus or an embryo, an infant or an adult, an old person, or one suffering from an incurable disease, a person who is dying. Furthermore, no one is permitted to ask for this act of killing themselves or for someone else, even under their care, nor can any authority legitimately recommend or permit such an action. For it is a question of the violation of the divine law, an offense against the dignity of the human person, a crime against life, an attack on humanity. What a sick person needs, we're told, besides medical care, is love. And the human and supernatural warmth which the sick person can and ought to be surrounded by all those close to him or her, parents and children, doctors and nurses. What a dying person needs, yes, to be made comfortable. Give them as much pain medicine that they can take without the pain medicine causing the death. No one has to endure any discomfort. So the doctors can give them as much morphine as possible without the morphine being the direct cause of death. Make them comfortable. But what's more important than that? Having their loved ones with them. Giving them support. Just being there. That presence. And allowing them to know that their suffering is holy. It's sacred. Mother Teresa of Calcutta used to say, every single person who suffers is being kissed by the crucified Christ. So those people who are enduring, especially that last agony, they're walking up the very hill of Calvary. And we have to allow them to do that. That doesn't mean that we don't have compassion. What it means is we have mercy in the full sense, as God does. The document continues. Physical suffering is certainly an unavoidable element of the human condition. According to Christian teaching, however, suffering, especially suffering during the last moments of life, has a special place in God's saving plan. It is, in fact, a sharing in Christ's passion, a union with the redeeming sacrifice which he offered in obedience to the Father's will. The Holy Father, Pope John Paul, wrote a beautiful letter, Salvifici Doloris, on human suffering. I encourage you to read that encyclical letter. It talks about redemptive suffering, something we don't hear about much these days. Imagine, though, every hospital, every nursing home, everyone with a disability, everyone with a disease, everyone with ache or pain, at that moment is being given a grace. Not that God's giving them the pain. No, that pain comes either from nature itself, through accident, or through our own human folly. But God's giving them a grace because of their suffering, the grace to bear the cross. And they witness to us by their endurance of that cross. God's not happy to see these people suffer. Do you think God the Father was happy to see God the Son on the cross? Do you think the Blessed Mother was happy to see Jesus with the nails in his hands and the thorns on his head? No. But she stood there and she supported him. And again, suffering can be redemptive if we use it. Not when we cause it, but when we use it. When we offer it up and unite it. So many times people use it as a trite phrase, we'll offer it up. Use it in its proper sense. You have a headache, you can offer that headache up and say, Lord, I offer this up to you for things I've done in the past, or think of someone you know and love. You offer it up for a relative who no longer goes to church. Instead of racing for the Tylenol, the Advil, or aspirin, or whatever you take, and using that immediately to get rid of the pain, see if you can endure it a little bit and offer it up. But we live in a society where as soon as there's any discomfort, we run immediately to alleviate it. We don't try to endure. Now, that doesn't mean that you refrain from all medicine, you refrain from all painkillers. What I'm saying is this instantaneous, almost knee-jerk reaction to absolutely avoid any discomfort at all costs. The athlete will tell you, no pain, no gain. We're not sadists or masochists in the Catholic Church. We're not telling people to cause or to seek intentionally pain or suffering. But when it finds you, use it to your advantage. Endure what you can and what you cannot endure. There's where medicine comes in and says, we can help you. We can help alleviate some of this. The document goes on. The suppression of pain and consciousness by the use of narcotics is permitted by religion and morality to the doctor and the patient. This is a quote from Pope Pius XII that's used in here. We're allowed to use medicine. You're allowed to take painkillers, okay? But it's our need to see that pain is not the ultimate enemy. It's sin. Some pain, some suffering can be used to save souls. It's not that the person who's sick is being punished by God. More often than not, it's an innocent person who suffers, someone who's completely blameless, and yet we see someone in a terrible condition and we wonder, what's going on? I think of my own brother who had muscular dystrophy, or my father who had leukemia, and here you see innocent people suffering, and you say, I don't understand, God. Here you've got these drug dealers, you've got these murderers, these rapists, they're in good health. Here you've got these good people who follow the commandments, they're suffering. And we don't understand. Read Father Benedict Rochelle's book, Arise from Darkness. It gives you a great insight to this idea of suffering. That suffering is not a punishment. In one sense, in the right sense, suffering is a gift. Because not that God gives it, but those who inevitably are, through no fault of their own, embracing it, they're now given a privilege. Jesus is saying, I want you to get closer to me. I want you to get so close to me, you're going to feel the wounds in your own body. And that person is going to sanctify souls. Souls from purgatory will be released. Ardent sinners will be softened. They will get mercy from God. People will now want to come back to the church, and they won't know where that had come from. That was a grace that was won for them by Jesus Christ, who intended that we unite our sufferings with His. He does not need it. Remember, we have St. Paul in his epistle telling us that he makes up in his body for that which is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. It wasn't that Jesus didn't do enough, but that he intended we unite ourselves with him. We're also told in this document that painkillers which cause unconsciousness need special consideration. Use the medication the doctor gives, but be careful. Some of these medicines are so powerful that they knock the person out or they make their thinking a little fuzzy. Well, then that's not the time for the doctor to come in and say, okay, now we've juiced up Grandpa with all this pain medicine. Now we want him to sign forms. We want him to sign these living wills. He's not in the proper frame of mind. That's not the time to be asking him, oh, Dad, now can I have the house? Can you sign over the car to me? Okay. Now's not the time to divvy up the inheritance. So that's the caution, that some of these drugs are so powerful, they impede someone's judgment. In the past, Morales replied that no one is obliged to use extraordinary means. We're never obligated to use every single possible method, no matter how expensive, no matter how experimental. We're obligated to use ordinary means. So for instance, if you cut yourself and you're bleeding and you go and get stitches, that's ordinary means. For someone to say, well, it's not natural to sew your flesh back together, I'll just bleed to death. That's stupid. That's suicidal. But for someone to go through experimental, well, this drug hasn't been tested yet. This procedure isn't proven. It's extremely costly. There's no guarantee. You don't have a reasonable hope of success. That's extraordinary means. And ordinary and extraordinary change over time. At the time of the Civil War, many painkillers were not even invented yet. In the very early days, antibiotics were experimental. Therefore, they were extraordinary. If you took them, you might even die not from the wound or the disease, but from the antibiotics. Today, they're commonplace. They're ordinary. So what's extraordinary today might be ordinary tomorrow. If you do come up with a living will, don't be too specific. You can put, I only want ordinary means. It puts a burden on your loved ones to consult perhaps their parish priest and the doctor at that time, but that's what we have to do. You can't put things down, well, I don't want this, I don't want that, because maybe what's extraordinary today will be ordinary tomorrow. But trust the judgment of your loved ones. You can make a moral living will, and most of our bishops' conferences at a local level have issued good, wonderful guidelines. Pennsylvania bishops, from where I come from, have done this. New Jersey bishops, and almost every bishop in the United States has done that. Euthanasia, the taking of life to alleviate suffering, is not the way to go. What we need to do is to support the suffering, being there for them, making them comfortable, and reminding them they are closer to Christ than you and I at that very moment. They're at the foot of Calvary. Well, we thank you for your kind attention and ask you to tune in again for another episode. May God bless you and Mary keep you.